Trigger warning. This episode includes, amongst many other things, first-hand testimony of racism, and that includes some offensive words. So please be aware before proceeding, and I'd suggest not listening in front of children. Hi, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? What are their go-to beauty routines? Are they obsessive about their appearance, or is it low on their list of priorities? And how have time and experience changed the way they feel about the way they look? Bearing all today is Ruby Hammer, MBE. Ruby is one of the British beauty industry's most well-loved and enduring figures. Many of us grew up watching her inspirational makeovers on BBC's The Clothes Show, wearing her truly innovative and inclusive makeup, Ruby and Millie, co-created with Millie Kendall, and wearing industry-changing brands like Aveda and L'Occitane, first brought into the UK by Ruby and her ex-husband George Hammer. Over 30 years on, Ruby Hammer still remains hugely relevant. Still a sought-after celebrity makeup artist and beauty presenter, she is also again at the helm of her own brand, making a small and expertly curated range of makeup tools and Ruby's own handbag essentials. Oh, and she's also aging in reverse. We're definitely going to have to come back to that.
But before that, a massive thank you to our wonderful series sponsor, Skin & Me. Skin & Me is your most accessible, fast track to simplified skincare, offering powerful active ingredients in formulations you can't buy on the high street. Skin & Me can create a treatment for your specific skin concerns, tailored to you by experts. Whether you want to target adult acne, pigmentation, melasma, rosacea, or skin aging, this is powerful, personalized skincare that truly works. As someone who has used Skin & Me for years, I can honestly say I wouldn't go without it. Later in this series, I'm delighted to say we'll be joined by one of Skin & Me's very own dermatologists to answer any and all of your pressing skincare questions. You can submit your question by emailing btb@insanityhq.com. That's btb@insanityhq.com. Now, on to today's episode of Beyond the Bathroom.
Welcome, Ruby Hammer.
Thank you, Sally. I'm blushing. You can't see.
It's so nice to have you here. I see you all the time, and we've never really had a talk about kind of where it all began. I suppose because I've been in this industry for so long, and you even longer. You just sort of accept people, don't you, in the industry? You never really hear anyone's origin story because we've all been knocking around for so long, and we're like part of the wallpaper, aren't we?
This is it.
So can we go way, way, way back to before you did this for a living and when you didn't do anything for a living? When was the first time you became aware of your own appearance, of how you look?
Well, so look, I was born in Nigeria, in Africa. My father was a doctor, gone out there when they'd just had their independence. So my life, my early life, until the age of 12, was in Africa. And that was quite wild. And my nickname was Mowgli because I was like the Jungle Book Mowgli. It was like straggly hair and I was dark and didn't sleep when it was my siesta and any of that. But I used to watch my mum, who, as my father progressed, that she'd be cooking on this big, you know, it was a log fire oven thing, I don't know, but she'd cook and she'd be all sweaty and then go and shower and transform herself to, at that time for me, it was like a Bollywood actress, you know, like, and it was the 60s and she was a young mum. She had me at 17. So she would have, you know, false eyelashes, all these little wig stands and things like you saw in fashion, like Pucci or Gucci outfits, but she'd have them in chiffon saris, you know, so those kind of prints, like go-go glasses and belts. And so she did all the fashionable things. So I was looking at that. That was inspiring. And
so you were growing up in Africa, but Could you just say what was your mother's cultural heritage so we can get a sense of all the influences?
Well, we were at that time, because now we call ourselves Bangladeshi, but I'm British by nationality now, because this is where I've been the rest of my life. But we were Asian, you know, Southeast Asian, and it was East Pakistan. So that's where we were. And there was no TV, me growing up, so there's no nothing. But we used to watch in open air space these Bollywood movies every night, really. And then you had sort of cartoons, you know, like Charlie Chaplin or Abbott and Costello and those kind of things. That was where I just saw the power of what makeup does, how it transforms women in particular, and saw my mum transformed. And I think, oh my God, she's like them. So lots of things, influences came that we are Asian. It was about Bollywood. I had no other, you know, yes, we saw Hollywood films, but these were the predominant influences. And then I learned to speak that language. And then we were on holiday here in the UK when a civil war started between East Pakistan and West Pakistan. My dad couldn't take us back to a war zone, didn't have a job in Africa at the time. So we just stayed here. And that was when I could look at telly, watch all the, you know, like all the magazines and cartoon books that we saw came alive, eating candy floss or going to a park, watching a bit of ballet, you know, all the things you read about but you don't really experience. Silly things, you know, like just, it was glorious. And then that became, this was our country then. You know, we had to go to the Home Office and change our, because we weren't refugees.
Yeah.
But we had to have a residency. We weren't given citizenship. And then after 5-6 years, whatever, then that became an Bangladesh allows dual nationality, so that's what I have. But I haven't renewed my Bangladesh passport since Mum died 11 years ago. I haven't had to go, so I haven't done it. So this is home. I studied. I was going to be a doctor like my dad, but I don't think I had the faculty for that. So it just went into social sciences. I studied economics. At the end of that education, I just got thrown in by chance to become a makeup artist, but I was an assistant. I wasn't I was fledgling. I just had to shut my mouth and watch what was going on.
That's what I did.
But their love and passion was there, because I used to do makeup on myself, you know, like when I was allowed. So from like 14, 15, I was allowed a bit of makeup. And my school allowed makeup, weirdly enough. It was a comprehensive school. They had a uniform, but we didn't have to wear it. And I went mad with my makeup.
So what are we talking here? Like bold, lurid colours?
Oh, my God. It was not just bold, everything. So every day, you know, we were a household of, I have two brothers younger than me, so I'd get up earlier, and so I'd be the first one to shower and get out there, and I used to wash my hair every single day. So it was all shiny and one length bob, and then sit down, and depending what I wore, I would do that. And before that, you'd be sort of poring over magazines and try and copy that, you know, whether it was a Yasmin Le Bon or Janice Dickinson or whoever.
So what year are we in now?
We would say this is in the 80s. So 82, 81.
So we're pre-supermodel. We're Janice Dickinson and Jerry Hall and Marie Helvin.
Exactly. Yeah. Iman, you know, Iman, Beverly Johnson, if they were the black, you know, the ones from Looking at American magazine.
Christy Brinkley.
Yes. All of that. So you had all the blonde ones like Kelly Emberg, Christy Brinkley, Paulina. They were the blonde ones. And then in the dark head, it was people like Iman and Janice Dickinson stood out. And you'd copy, oh, I could do that sun-kissed look. I could do this. But I never wore the same makeup look 2 days in a row, Sally. It was always different.
And did you know you were good at it?
I didn't know, not like that. I just knew I was good at doing my face. And if we did go out, my friends would come home to me and my mum would feed us. And then I was useless at doing my hair. So somebody would probably mess around with my hair and I would try and do their makeup. So that's the extent. It wasn't a thing that, oh my God, you can be a professional makeup artist. It wasn't any of that. But looking at magazines, and I used to work in Harrods as my Saturday job from the age of 16 onwards. So part of that money, I could use the discount to look at and buy magazines or just flick through them when they were the very expensive ones. I'd just sort of flick through there in my lunch hour. But you you sort of glean information. Oh, look, that kind of look is on, or that kind of colour is in there, and then try and replicate it to myself.
And so what was that? Do you think that was about the doing of the makeup that you found fascinating, the acquisition of the skill, or was it the wearing of the makeup? Did it make you feel a certain way when you were done?
I think it was both. It was the doing, because it was taking time for yourself, you know, and improving your skills. I had to learn, oh my God, how did they do that? And it wasn't like digital now. There's no way of finding out. If they showed it on the side of a beauty type story, you might emulate that, but it's nothing like it is now, where the information out there, the sources of information is just so vast. It wasn't like that, so you just sort of figured it out. And so the doing was fantastic because it was done on me, and the feeling is my own little time, you know.
Did it make you feel when you were all kind of done up, I suppose, and ready to go out? What would you do? Go to clubs, gigs? What would you do?
So we would go at the weekends. It were clubs, you know. I liked soul music. I liked Motown music. So I wasn't a big, growing up in Africa, it was the radio stations and the Indian music, but I wasn't a sort of big rock music person, because it wasn't. We used to dance and it was funk and that. But yet when I'd get the bus going to school and you'd go past King's Road or something and you watch the punks, and that makeup was fascinating. So it wasn't about music or the fashion of what they wore. It was like how they did their makeup. That's what fascinated me. And I would replicate it. So I wasn't a punk at school. I wasn't a teddy boy. I wasn't a this. I wasn't a... And it was just another extension of myself. And I was very academic. I was good at school. You know, people would befriend me, but they didn't think I was some geek. Mm-hmm. Not that there's anything bad about being a geek, but I did my work. I had very good scores in my academic work. I sort of was sporty as best as I could. You know, I wasn't the best thing at anything, but they would all look at me in my makeup and go, oh, what have you got on today? And do you want to do that? And what was that? And so there was always that, and it made me feel good about it. And I was always a sharer. You know, I never kept it all. I'm not telling you what that is. Or one time there was there's a brand, I don't know if you'd know, it's called Princess Galitzine.
Yes. Oh,
you see, but it was only sold in Harrods and maybe Selfridges, I don't know. And I'd go down and, you know, they were like £11 then.
Yes, which was loads of money. Yeah.
And I would save and then use my discount, so I would get it at sort of £8. And they'd go, what is that? And I'd go, well, this is this one. And then we'd try and go to Miss Selfridge or Rimmel, or there's another one called Miners.
Yes, Miners.
All that to try and find what could be like that. So it was those kind of sharing and trying bits.
Let's pause briefly to thank our brilliant series sponsor, Skin and Me. As this episode covers, skincare is crucial in creating a better base for your makeup. A stripped-down skincare routine is key, whether you want to go fresh-faced or full-faced. Skin and Me offers powerful, personalized skincare designed by experts with formulations you won't find on the high street and delivered directly to your door. Skin and Me creates highly effective treatments and has case studies, reviews, progress images, press, and awards to prove it. Every single consultation and photo set submitted by Skin and Me members is personally reviewed by an expert dermatology clinician, and all formulations are made to order and evolve as each skincare journey progresses. Regular check-ins with the dermatology team ensure Skin and Me members are always able to amend their treatment and access expert advice when they need it. Because Skin and Me products are effective, you don't need a complicated routine with countless products. A stripped-back regime saves money and maximizes your results. Great skin tomorrow starts today. Try your first month of personalized treatment from Skin and Me for $4.99 instead of the usual $24.99. Just visit skinandme.com and use the code SALLYANDME to get started.
So you mentioned that your mum was really glamorous and would transform herself, and it sounds like she was quite an open-minded mum. you know, and encouraged or certainly allowed your experimentation. What about you? Did you feel pretty? Did you ever look in the mirror and think, I'm pretty, or I like the way I look? Or was it for you more about the experimentation of it?
It was kind of both, because I was really, really skinny. Yeah. And I was quite dark, and I'm the eldest, and I've got two younger brothers. And when we would go to home, which I say Bangladesh, you know, on holidays after 2 years, we'd have 4 months vacation and we'd go home. They did used to think, because you're so skinny, you're not fair skinned. They used to think, oh my God, doctor's going to have to spend a lot of money getting rid of this one off their hands, you know, if she was going to get married. So some of that was about being skinny and getting upset because I wasn't the full, you know, I wasn't fair skinned. I was very chiseled, you know, I had good bone structure, which I now realise when I came to this country that it was an asset.
Yeah.
Whereas it was looked down upon, oh my God, she looks like she hasn't eaten, or she's not fair at all. And, you know, all of that. So there was some negative elements, but my parents, they didn't just focus on the outward appearance, but my father would say, oh my God, when somebody loves how you look, Ruby, they're gonna love how you are. So my dad was a big booster like that. And aww, my mum, her weight, I can't remember when she was young, but as we get into teenage year, her weight fluctuated, and she would go, oh, can't wear this blouse now, especially in the summer with her beautiful coloured saris. But she never made it like it was a negative that you didn't look a certain way or were built a certain way or you only look good with makeup and you don't look good without, because she was a bit like me. Look, I've come with fresh face with nothing on, just my skincare now. And yet if I'm going somewhere, I will make an effort with the makeup. So it was always part and parcel of you as a human being that you could achieve everything in this world if you set your mind to it. And they gave us, both parents, that unconditional love and boost of confidence that say, you don't have to look good every day. It's natural to be clean-faced, but then you address it when you want. And, oh, this is a religious ceremony, it's Eid, or we're going to someone's wedding, or it's someone's birthday party. So you make an effort with clothes, with your hair, with yourself, to smell nice, to talk nice with your manners, to be attentive, to be open. All of that was, emphasis was put on that, not just physical appearances.
I mean, it's so interesting. I've done so many of these conversations, and this just comes up time and time again as such an influential part of people who are quite accepting of their own appearance, that they had parents who were accepting of not only their appearance, but their own appearance, their parents themselves. And it seems to be such an influential factor.
It's if a your positive mum, role model, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's,
if your mum wasn't moaning about how she looked, and God knows there are a million reasons given to women to moan about how they look. Nobody's blaming the mums. They didn't live in a bubble. They lived in a really, really difficult kind of patriarchal world. But mums who criticised their own appearance a lot, that carries on, right? That carries on to your daughters, to your sons. And just, it sounds like you didn't have that.
You know, in your subconscious, like I remember my mum was young and I said, I think it was probably in her 20s. So by 21, she'd had all three children. And it was when we were here. At some stage, something must have happened, and then my mum got adult acne, full blown. And that was, I could see that was traumatic for her. Mm-hmm. She would go to Selfridges and she would have this facial and these products and that. And I saw, so it's not like I just thought, I think my mum was beautiful, but she went through a crisis at some point, and then her weight did fluctuate, but she addressed it, dealt with it, you know, would diet, would not, but took care of this. But it was never, oh my God, if you didn't achieve some level of excellence or perfection or looked, mustn't be seen without this or without that, but always made an effort. But it was not the be all of everything. It was nice to cook. She was a wonderful cook. I'm a useless cook because she fed me so nicely. And then she would go, no, go and do your homework because that's important now. And then I'd be doing my ritual. You know, like I didn't have that much money, but I had a written thing, things you do daily, things you do weekly, things you do monthly. You know, like so I'd weekly put a mask on, do my nails, do your feet, oil up, put oil in your hair or whatever, avocado or honey or yogurt, do all that, scrub up, and then once a month do something else but go for your haircut. And I think I'd overplucked my eyebrows once and I was told not to touch them for the whole of the summer holidays. Then I didn't go out because they were like bushy growing here, there and everywhere, because I had literally one hair. And there is a picture of me somewhere, but you look like permanently startled like that. And I remember my dad came home, opened the door, and he went, what the hell have you done? Why do you like that? And she went, oh, don't say, it's her eyebrows, she's taken them all out. I was allowed to pluck two, and I would have had the most lush ones, but I'd every day one.
Yeah.
So there was always, you know, life and a measure of looking at things and things didn't
perspective.
Work. Yeah. But it was always put into perspective.
And what about the outside world? So you mentioned you weren't refugees, but you had to leave your home because of civil war.
We were going home. We were settling at home. This was our vacation. And you just had to culturally adjust to the cold.
Well, that's what I'm interested about, in that, you know, it's so you arrive as a brown child, a brown family in Britain. It's a different time. I mean, God knows there's plenty of racism now. That time, it was a very specific time in history where I would imagine you would have experienced a sense of otherness at times.
Well, you do in the beginning. One is you're at that funny age where everything is an adjustment. You know, I'm not quite a teen, but I am
It's a funny old time for identity anyway.
Yeah. Then you've come, I spoke English because we spoke English in Nigeria, and I don't know if I had a accent, not really, but I had a, you know, we spoke English. But there was a little bit of racism because, you know, it was the days of Enoch Powell.
Yes.
Floating around.
Yes.
So that was outside, and my school had a mixture of everything because it was South London, it was in Putney. So we had black children from Tooting, Clapham, we lived in Wandsworth / Putney, but we had all mixtures. But also they did sort of say, oh yeah, look at her, bet she doesn't speak any English, bet she's one of them Gujaratis, and bet they don't, she might have to go to a remedial class. And I used to think, remedial class? I speak English. We were just polite. We were not told to speak unless spoken to. In my old school, you know, it was like missionary school or whatever school I went to in Nigeria, as soon as an adult entered the room, we stood up. You spoke when you were spoken. So this used to make them laugh in the comprehensive school. So it was funny where they'd go. They'd be holding on to my back of my jacket or my clothes to stop me standing up when somebody walks in the room. And then they saw that I can have a laugh. I do speak English. I do try and fit in. And then said, do you like Bay City Rollers or David Cassidy? And I'm like, who are they? And then they'd explain to you. But when you ask normally, who are they? Oh, I don't know. So show me their music. But this is who I like, James Brown. And they'd go, bloody hell. You know, like if you're open to take on experiences and to guide you that way, I fitted in a nice way. But there would be some comments, like outside school, if you're on a bus stop or you'd see somebody and they go, oh, are you a Paki? Are you a Paki? And I'd go, no, I'm from Bangladesh. You know, and I'd go, why they keep calling everyone a Paki? And you'd ask your mum and she has even less information about that. But it wasn't ever, or maybe I've blotted it out, it wasn't so traumatic experience. It's just something we experience. That's it. You know, maybe the boys felt it more in the boys' school and there's a bit more of that and they were a bit younger.
And what about entering the beauty industry? So I know you're working at Harrods and you ended up assisting because you're working in the beauty department. That's right, isn't it?
Well, it came from my husband, my boyfriend who became my husband, so by this time I finished university and I helped my mum. She used to run an Indian restaurant, quite a famous one called Red Fort in Dean Street. And George used to come in all the time and it was fashion week or whatever. He was in there and I just was trying to earn some extra money or deciding, do I go and do further education, get a master's, or do I get a job? Do I take a year out? And in that time, he introduced me to a friend of his. She was a makeup artist. And he said, you love your makeup, you love doing it, so ask her. And she literally said, yes, threw one of these passes at me and said, all right, if you come. And she said, I'll see you at 4 tomorrow morning. And I was like, 4 o'clock in the morning. And all the shows used to be in the Duke of York
barracks, in the barracks
in Chelsea.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because we lived in Putney, my mum said, I'll drop you off at 4. She drove and dropped me up. But I was like, 4 o'clock. And she said, well, we've got over 35 girls. When do you think you want to come in? And I assisted. That didn't stop for about 2 years. You know, I got better until she gave me some of her least worst paid jobs. Mm-hmm. But they were like more money than I'd ever earned. So it was great. You know, so I just climbed up the ladder, you know, where I'd be the assistant doing shows. And then I became the lead artist if she was doing something bigger or whatever. But she did commercials, she did shows, she did editorials. So I had a good training in all aspects of that and to organise yourself. And so it's self-taught. I didn't go to a school. Like, I'd love to have been like Lisa Eldridge and Charlotte Tilbury, where they all went to Glauco Rossi and Maida Vale now, where I live. So I know when I go past that, it gives me a little...
Yes, lots of great artists started there. there.
But it was really funny when I was 16, because I was such a tomboy, my mum got me 20 Saturdays. It was at the London School of Modelling in Bond Street. And the makeup teacher there was Glauca Rossi.
Okay.
So look at the circle, where she used to teach you not on other people how to do makeup, but on yourself, so that you would know how to sit, get into the car.
Yeah.
Not, she didn't teach those classes.
Yes, but it makeup was a 360.
So she used to do half a face, she used to do, and then you had to match those blending skills and do it well. So you see, I have had influence from my mum or someone like her to say, Glauca used to say, blend that, that's not good enough. It would always be, yes, I like the choice of colour, you've done this, you've done that, but more blending, no missing these. And sometimes she'd do half and you'd, then it was a coffee break or lunch break, and you'd have to go out with that half a face to go eat your sandwich outside, and people would look at you, what the hell? But you know, so there are lots of lovely influences from Glauca, I forgot about her till that far back, from my assisting days, but mostly just practice. That's a good thing with makeup. It doesn't matter who that is.
Just wash it off.
Exactly. You can always wash it off, but you need to practice it. You can't just, oh, that says do that and hold it in this angle and that angle. You have to try it on yourself or on others.
There was, so I remember that time in the industry very well.
And you were a great artist at that time yourself, weren't you?
Oh, I definitely wasn't great, but I was an assistant, and that's how I learned. And that time in the industry was an exciting time. There were lots of creative people. There were lots of great people to meet. But it has to be said, there were not many brown and black makeup artists. There really weren't. Pat hadn't started yet at this point.
No.
Or was roughly starting round about then, but there really weren't very many, certainly none for ages, that went on to have their own brands, which we'll come back to. But I'm wondering how those experiences of working with predominantly white models, surrounded by predominantly white makeup artists, might have informed the kind of makeup you wanted to create, not just on faces, but in terms of the product itself that you went on to make with Boots.
The weirdest thing is, look, I am Asian. I look Asian, I'm of that background. But when I not set out, I just wanted to be the best at what I did, or achieve as best as I could. Because, you know, in those early days, I already was married and I had a daughter. So I couldn't do what people like Di Kendall or afterwards Pat or anyone, just go off to Paris, go off to New York.
Right.
And I had those creative partnerships with, whether it's a hairdresser or a particular photographer, and then off they go. If I had gone off myself, I would have been another bigger name or different, you know, your life would have taken on a different path. But I had to stay here because this was my family. This is my base. And I also had a particular style of doing my own makeup. It wasn't very heavy handed.
Yes.
So I remember if I just wanted to do Asian makeup or think, it would be heavy on the eyeliner. It would be heavy on the base. And that wasn't my particular aesthetic. So I didn't veer in that way. And I do remember, you know, in those days, it wasn't having, you know, Instagram or having a thing or portfolio. You had to have a model card, the way models have
like
it.
A Z card.
We had to have that as makeup artists or hairdressers to show examples of the different styles of what makeup. So on my card, one of them was a beautiful one done by a very big photographer at that time called Carrie Branovan. And it was three back girls. And it was for Harper's Bazaar, or Harper's and Queen, as it was called at that time. And it was three black girls, different shades of them, one very cocoa, one dark. And it was Ilias Lalouni's fantastic high-end jewellery. But they were kind of bare-skinned with this gold jewellery. And I had that on my card on one side. And then the other side had a bit more commercial, you know, fair-skinned, blonde, this one, that one. And from working, I never got a call back. And then my agent, I said, but suddenly, this beautiful card, and why don't I get any work? And then they looked, and it really came back, Sally, where they said, oh, we just thought she did black makeup. That was the main image.
It's mad, isn't
so
it?
I just had you to do turn
a white,
it around.
You do a white girl, and you
they
do
just,
everyone.
They just
You
assumed,
do a black girl, and you just do black girls.
They
yeah.
assumed I just did that. And it was rare to find a black model at that time. I did work with Naomi Campbell in her youth and a few others, and mostly in the shows, and you wouldn't see that much on editorial, you know, or on a beauty story, lo and behold. No. So it's really, there's no sudden crash bang. It's just keep doing what you do, trying to do all skin tones. I found all aspects of beauty, all colouring, all shapes and sound, lovely. It appealed to me. So I just pushed that way. I wasn't a big loud megaphone person. I just kept doing what I do.
I think I know what you mean about that. Your manner is soft. You're quite a soft person, and I've known you a long time, and your manner is just like that. You're soft and you're elegant, and I think it would be easy to assume that, you know, you're polite and soft and you don't push. But actually, for anybody who remembers Ruby and Millie launching, it was a game changer. It really was, because it wasn't just inclusive in terms of skin tone, but it was very defiantly affordable. You know, at that time, there was a long period of time where especially women of colour, if they wanted something for their skin, they had to spend. And it's still true to a certain extent now.
Yes.
That the deeper your skin tone, the more money you need to spend and the less accessible the high street is. But what you and Millie Kendall did was, no. Our brand has to be affordable and it has to include everybody.
And also inclusive, not just in choice and range of colour, but where you retail. You know, like now we have e-commerce different sites, so it's globally easier. But at that time, to choose a partner, you know, we launched in Harvey Nichols and Selfridges, but to then partner up with somebody like Boots, who actually were the founder. They are the ones that backed us. We didn't own it. Everyone had this assumption that we owned it, but we didn't. They put money behind us. And to be on a high street, so picking a retailer like that, that's accessible, that was also a conscious decision to say that means it's available.
Yes.
Across the nation. And partly maybe why it didn't work out towards the end with someone like Boots is we signed on for a global brand. So we had opportunities to take this abroad. You know, we were in Thailand and Taiwan, but we wanted to be in America because that's what we thought. And for some reason at that time, I don't know, Boots wouldn't allow us many which way we tried to think. So It would have been even a bigger brand if it had been able to cross the waters. It would have been bigger. But we tried. Just gradually, you know, having worked with Aveda, and, you know, again, that's that bit of knowing something could be natural or organic or working with horse or could it be sustainable. Just asking those questions. How inclusive is it? How... all of that. So my whole life is like when somebody goes, do you just do this? And I think, no, that's how it's been my whole life. I was born in Africa where I'm surrounded predominantly with black faces, black people. But I'm Asian, so I know I'm not quite like them. I'm Caucasian with straight hair. And I remember sitting any lunchtime, they would play with your hair. Or my, you know, you'd be sitting there. They'd braid it, they'd plait it, they'd just stroke it. I love having my hair touched even now.
So do I. Yeah.
But you'd have to say, I'm getting up now. Because if I just moved, I'd have a yank. Oh, my hair pulled because somebody was doing something to it. Then you come for the little bit of travel. You know, my father was Muslim, would go to Saudi Arabia, would go to Mecca. Our dear, dear friends were Lebanese, would go to Lebanon. So you could ski 1 minute, you'd be swimming on the beach the next minute. We traveled as best we could. My aunt used to work for the UN. So there's all of these influences that have always been in us. And my father always made you feel it doesn't matter who you are, what you are, man, woman. He didn't make the kind of discrimination between a male child and what I was as a female child. Lock me up and give them freedom, allow you this or like it was really, that is in my roots, and hence it's in my heart, and it's the way I
sense
do things.
Of fairness and
yes,
equality.
There is that. Yeah. So when people think you're stepping on a bandwagon, I said no. And even now, when I go to things, Sally, it's quite unbelievable where I think of myself as, oh, they like me because I was the artist, and actually, no, they were like, you were a brown face on telly. So I realise, oh my God, you were a role model without trying to be gung-ho.
Of course.
One. But they saw it. But
you were also visible.
Yeah. And also for other people, because I did it not just as an Asian or as a black woman. I just did it for all of us women. Like even now, I'm in my 60s. I'm 61 now. It's all about all of us. First, the human being that I am, then the sex that I am, whether you're a mother, I'm a working mother, you have a sisterhood, and then there's humanity. For God's sake, every part of all of that has relevance, and you do what you can.
I can't let the I'm in my 60s comment hang in the air without coming back to it. It is so ridiculous. I realise we're talking on an audio platform and you can't physically see Ruby. So there's a thing about Ruby Hammer, right, that exists in our industry. Whenever you are anybody, anywhere, talking to anybody, and you say, oh, who's coming? And somebody will go, oh, I think Ruby's coming. I've seen Ruby on table. And somebody will always say, bloody hell, how does Ruby Hammer look like that? It is actually immoral how good you look at the age you are. You have always been so beautiful. I mean, you just are. And yes. I know you're not going to agree with me because you'll be mortified, but you are just a beautiful woman. That is just objectively true. And thank it's you. Always oh. been true. And everybody thinks that about you, Ruby. But the fact that you're now in your 60s and you look the way you do is actually mind-blowing. You're going to have to tell us. I mean, I have a horrible feeling you're about to blame genetics, which will be annoying, but you are going to have to tell us what you do day to day, please, because it is, you're like the Benjamin Button of the beauty industry. Oh, so can we start? And everyone says this. This is not me blowing smoke at Ruby's bum. Honestly, the whole industry constantly is like, what the hell has Ruby Hammer been drinking? So can we start with your skincare routine? I know you are obsessed with skin. You love skin, don't you?
I do thank genetics, and I did win the lottery there. But winning the lottery has a downside too. Like, you know, you have to look
interesting.
At it
go
with
on.
Everything, because I look like my dad. I'm my features, my thing. And then my mum was a bit more petite, 5'2", but she was rounder and just, you know, she had different features in the funny way to what I am. But she took care of her skin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had that. My dad was just simple hygiene. But I am obsessed with skin, like you say, because I think that's the foundation of cosmetics. There's no point putting on colour and all the other nitty-gritty of all of that if the structure, the base isn't there. And it means you need less colour if the actual skin is vibrant and healthy and nourished and tight, whatever. And that doesn't mean used to work on 10 years younger, I remember driving the resident, you know, the plastic surgeon or whoever, mad, because I used to ask questions, not just for myself, but people ask me questions. So I used to drive him mad and get there. So I know that I'm never going to go under the knife, Sally. I know that. And I'm not going to have fillers. But I have had Botox, mm-hmm. and it was in my chin.
Mm-hmm.
Not really around my eyes or mm-hmm. that. It was in my chin, because that's the most flexible part mm-hmm. of you, and that's where you're going to age a little bit.
Sure.
But I take care. So as soon as I was an assistant and you read a bit more, you're a bit more aware, I knew about sun protection. So I knew about cleansing. Whatever it is, and I don't care. People want like big brands, or does it have to be expensive? Does it have to be cheap? I think it doesn't matter, darling. Just you have to clean your skin. So I do have, balms, I have oils, I have micellar water, I have that. So depending what's appropriate at that time and how time poor I am, that's what I do, but I do cleanse.
You're never in bed with your makeup on, ever.
Yeah. There's been a lot of time. It might be left on my eyes, but I do a good wipe on my face. And then the next day I make up for that. So you take longer to slough that off. Mm-hmm. And I do cleanse from my chest. Done that. I saw my mum always with a flannel.
So boobs to hairline.
All of that. I do use an eye makeup remover, and some people don't, and those balms do spread, but I don't like getting the oil on my eyes because I was contact lens wearer and all that. And I just find you scrub a bit more, and I don't like scrubbing down there because I don't want the lines down there. So I use an eye makeup remover first, then I do very good cleanse. Double cleanse if needed. Exfoliation. When you're younger and the skin is sloughing quicker, it doesn't need much help. It could be a flannel, it could be a granule one, it could be now there are serum ones, chemical ones, whatever. I do believe you do give that help because it gives radiance and softness.
And a good base for makeup, right? A nice smooth base.
Yeah, exactly. And then hydration. Now, whether it's Kiehl's Ultra Facial, normal, no smelling, nothing, or you want a high-end luxury, whether that's Augustinus Bader, Decorte, Claire de Peau, Creme de la Mer, whatever it is, and I say, buy the best you can afford. You see, what people sometimes tend to do, I don't think you have to buy something expensive and it's going to give you a great result. But it's the routine and how often you use it. That's when you're going to see the result.
100%.
I love your range, you know, like the moisturizer, I love. It's in my kit. Aww. It's just, and when you know skin, you know all of that work. So it's about...
It's what you do most of the time.
Yes.
This is what I say to people. What is not particularly influential is having a mask here, a pamper day there. It's what do you do most of the time. That's what affects your
Look
skin.
Look at red carpet people. Look at... Right. Okay, I'll give you a great example. At the moment now is Margot...
Robbie.
Yes. Going around the whole world doing her, she's going to be doing her Barbie, and it's not just about being pink, but anybody of that ilk, when they have to be on the red carpet and they're photographed and they're videoed and they're on social media, if they didn't have somebody or a routine in place, whether that's okay, now you're going to your facial, now you're eating this, now you're doing that, you cannot get their nails polished and done quickly, as quick as they have to travel and do the other bits, if it wasn't already some semblance of grooming in place, meaning your hair colour, your mm-hmm. eyebrows, mm-hmm. your nails, your skin, your lip, something has to be in place, because then it's easy mm-hmm. to polish up. If you're going to do that, oh, I've got a wedding coming and it's 4 months down the road, I'm not going to do anything, but that 1 hour before, can you make me into a queen? I've just booked you. You're a celebrity makeup artist.
Yeah.
Make me look like a celebrity.
Yeah.
Well, it's not going to wash. It doesn't yeah. work like that.
Yeah.
You know, and there are creams and things that I might use on you once, but there are cumulative effort and results, whoever that brand is, whatever that price is, the more you do, the better. And then the last thing on there is the SPF, the sun protection.
And I mean, it's really good to hear you say that as somebody with melanated skin, because I think that women of colour are so ignored in the SPF conversation, and it is absolutely vital for everybody.
See, I don't worry about wrinkles as such, but I get pigmentation, so the marks
exactly.
will stay
exactly.
longer. And actually, they say that, and they prove it now, don't they, that it's not how many wrinkles you've got and the depth of the wrinkles, but the tone of your skin gives away your age. So I have had sometimes, you know, if you use a retinoid, or I've picked myself, or some too harsh a product or whatever, it goes in cycles. You know, I'm
sure.
a human being. You have stress that takes a horrendous toll on your skin. Not sleeping well, exercising, which I've come to late in my life, eating, just love and joy, and all of those have bearing on everything. So you try to be as balanced, as joyful a person as you can be, thinking good thoughts. I think wishing well to people right from the bottom of your heart means you're going to get that back, and it
That's
shows
really
on your
true.
Face. It
That's
shows.
Really,
it's
really
grace.
True.
It's just grace. And some days when it's terrible, accepting that and thinking, oh, I'm having a really shitty crap day, and you go and hide in your duvet and you come back and know that tomorrow is another day. Whatever it is, I'm not a saint and I'm not perfect, and I wasn't given, you know, like, I've aged. If you compare me to what I looked like in the Ruby Millie days when I was the face of the brand too. And yes, there was a little bit of retouching. It's big posters. There's all of that. So that's the other thing I want to say to people. Look, sometimes it is about filters. Sometimes it's about the light. It's about the talent of that photographer who took your picture. Or sometimes you just got caught in a good light. Sometimes it's nothing and it was joyful.
The difference between lighting is just it is unreal.
But there is sometimes that bit of they lit you so well and
yeah.
you look magnificent. How am I going to repeat that out of a cream?
And what would you say to women who are maybe thinking, they're getting older and thinking, should I adapt? Should I change my makeup? What would be your tip for the most flattering makeup as your skin starts to age? And maybe you're fine with it, maybe you're not fine with it, but what's the most flattering kind of makeup tricks for people who are getting older?
I think less is more as you get older, just
yeah.
because it's not, the surface is not as tight, it's not as smooth, it's not as voluminous, you know, so you could put 3 tons of cover and it will look okay.
I used
okay.
to wear so much makeup.
Whereas,
when I was younger.
So did I.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't, you know, I used to wear tons on my eyes and touch wood, not so much foundation, but tons.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did, I would.
Mm-hmm.
now, because it's thinner and it's a bit more crepey, it will sit in those lines. So then there's things of, it depends what stage of menopause you may be going through, or whether you have a hot flush, is it rosacea, is it not, what you're trying to hide or what you're trying to illuminate, all of that. So I would say the biggest tip I can give to someone is know yourself. I don't know it perfectly, but I'm trying to always know with myself, what was that, what used to work, what doesn't work anymore. But you keep, without being obsessed, you know, you can't be self-obsessed and looking at every little thing. But if you're aware of your own changes, you'll be able to diagnose or navigate that water a bit better than just looking at others to give you info.
Before we go, there's one aspect of aging I really want to talk to you about, because I know you're so generous about talking about this, and I know it's so pertinent and relevant to so many women, is that you have found your hair has thinned as you've got older. This is just something I hear every single day and from real women, and yet not something I particularly hear about in the wider world in terms of communication around beauty. And I know that it's something that you've thought about and talked about a lot. Tell us when your hair started thinning and how that made you feel.
I think, and again, this is the genetic lottery.
Right.
I have inherited,
sure,
this. I don't want to call it a disorder, whatever. But it's a.
I mean, it's very normal, yeah, but it doesn't make it less distressing.
So I, as an Asian woman, you know, where you're talked about as having very long, dark, lush hair.
Yeah.
I never had very long, lush hair because I was too much of a tomboy and I'd just keep cutting it like that. So I've had it long, but never like that. And that wasn't my style, you know. Then when it was here, I just wanted clean, shiny hair. I would get stopped all my life on the bus, crossing the zebra crossing, excuse me, what shampoo do you use? Because it's so shiny. And it was just Vosine or Head and Shoulders, whatever it was at that time. I was a wash and go girl. And as I've gotten older, so I did lose some hair when I was breastfeeding, and I breastfed my daughter a year. So yes, you have some shedding, all that.
Course.
And I never paid attention. I was not very good with my hair anyway. I'd just knock it out.
Especially not with a newborn baby.
It was always wash and go. I wasn't one of like using hair tools to put that flat or whatever. But and then Ruby and Millie days was probably when professionally we got our hair done, because for the picture, and you know, it got done. So I was on the other side of the thing. So I worked with some of the best hairdressers in the world. So you pick up things, but it wasn't what I applied to myself. And then I was probably going thinner little by little by little. And then probably when my mum passed away or got diagnosed with cancer, then my hair went grey overnight and I stopped
because
my period.
That was traumatic, right?
Traumatic, and it took me into the menopause. So some of that hair loss is gradual. So it's not, I don't have alopecia, you know, there wasn't a patches anywhere. It was just a gradual shedding. And then you sort of, when you've examined menopause, you think, oh God, yeah, that is hormonal, I've got to check it. Then the pandemic comes and then I was really good for 2.5 years, and then just towards the end of it, I got COVID. So then there was excessive shedding. So I don't know, it's post-COVID, it is genetic. And then I have been told by going to Philip Kingsley and whatever that, yes, I have got this female pattern boarding, and that's what it is. It literally is, like if I was a man, it would be in that, it's around your crown. Mm-hmm. And now again, I kind of let it go for a bit. I'm going to have to address it again because the gaps are really, really big. So you do silly things like for middle parting, I've changed it to a side parting because it's less obvious. But now even that gap, I used to call it, oh my God, it looks like the Grand Canyon here. When it's coloured, it looks better because you don't see the little white. It looks a bit more dense, but I am going to have to tackle it again. And I've realised, as much as I spent effort on my skin, I probably do less on my hair, and I'm going to have to go again because you have to do it daily. I'm going to have to maybe have PRP and maybe do the serums. And then do I take something that's like minoxidil, because I'm like, oh God, I'm going to have to do that forever. I'm quite matter of fact that, okay, do I have to have a weave, or will I have to have a wig in the end, or I don't know. So I'm going to have to dress all this again because it's very noticeable again.
You mentioned that you're somebody who never particularly bothered with her hair. You were around hairdressers. It wasn't a priority. You had children. You were a makeup person or whatever. And I think, you know, that's true for lots of women. You didn't particularly pay attention to it. And so was it a sort of surprise in a way to find that your hair, actually without you realising it, was really important to you and to your identity and how you felt about yourself?
I knew it intellectually as a makeup artist, knowing when you're doing the picture, even if the hairdresser's just there to, it's a frame that makes my makeup look or makes her image look amazing. So there's all this. But he was like, oh, it's for the... It wasn't personal. And I just used to do it like that and it looked all right. And then now when you realise there's a freaking gaping hole here and somebody takes a picture and in a picture you look like there's a 50 pence gap there and you think, oh, I'm going to have to put a bit of brown shadow or colour powwow or, oh my God, oh, that... And you, it hits home. So that has shown, oh my God, that is a bit of my aging. And that makes you feel, address your aging aspect, because I have been lucky. I don't show it on my face. And now with having tail end of menopause, yes, I see a middle girl, you know, so it hits home and it reflects on you. So when somebody goes, you look the same, and I'm like, no, have you seen my hair? And it comes out like that, not as a negative or I'm feeling insecure on that, but that's the truth of it, that did show me, oh my God, right there, it could affect and did affect my confidence and think, I'm going to have to address that. Then when some people say to you how bad they feel about something, you realise, oh my God, that's what they've been feeling. Thank God I was kind, or...
Yes.
And now I understand that.
It's
empathy,
thing.
Not just sympathy for myself, and realising, okay, this is how...
I think so many women are going through it, either specifically female pattern baldness, or have lost their hair through chemo, or something traumatic to have happened in their life, or some related illness or unrelated illness. Is such a common thing, and I hear about it all the time.
Yeah, because sometimes it is temporary shedding, and it could be stress, or you've had alopecia, whatever, you're not eating well, or you're not something like that. So I knew it wasn't that, because I've got stress. Look, if you're doing what we do for the last how many years we've been doing it, that is our occupational hazard, isn't it? That level of stress is there. We travel, we go here, we do, it's there. So it wasn't that. Then I thought, okay, post-COVID, that. Then you realise, no, there is shedding, there is this. This is my condition. So at least I've identified what it is, and now I'm going to have to address it. And there are things now, you know, people talk about this, that taboo of hair loss. It used to be taboo about menopause, but I also want to expand on the menopause thing, that we're not all doom and gloom, you know, that is all at the end of life, at midlife, and that you don't do anything else. So yes, it's got some real issues we have to address, but also it doesn't just stop. That isn't the end all of everything. You still have a laugh, you're still sexy, want to be, do the things. So not everything has to just be, the wider and more open we can be about things. And it comes from all kinds of sources. You just have to keep yourself open about that. That keeps you youthful.
I can't imagine you ever stopping. Thank you so much for coming to talk to me, Ruby Hammer. That's it for this episode. Thanks so much to the luminous Ruby Hammer for putting her best face forward. Please subscribe and follow Beyond the Bathroom wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave a rating and a review. I'll see you next time with another guest.
Insanity Group.